around here. Just a tiny town. Kenny watched a crane lift a steel container of preformed fiberglass motel bathtubs. And this stretch of US-1 is so empty it's almost toxic. Darby stopped to rest. That's why it's so attractive to people who are doing everything they shouldn't be doing. How do you know? Like I said, you work long enough in a place, you pick up vibes. His cane navigated another treacherous step near the new cruise ship terminal with tinted green glass. I want to introduce you to some people. They arrived in a covered portion of a shipyard. Hard hats, echoes of clanging metal, acetylene torches, and showers of sparks.
Brady.
No answer. Darby wrapped his hands around his mouth.
Brady!
A welding helmet looked around. Then a hand in a thick glove raised the visor.
Darby!
The welder turned around.
Hey, everyone, look who's here! It's Darby!
All work came to an abrupt halt as a crowd of fireproof aprons circled the former co-worker. Smiles and slaps on his back.
How's it been hanging?
You still look great.
Been meaning to visit.
Would have called, but with the kids in school.
They migrated over to a picnic table next to the igloo ice water dispensers.
What brings you here?
Asked Brady.
I want you to meet my friend, said Darby. This is Kenny Reese.
Kenny?
The gang.
The famous author?
Kenny blushed. Still a little bashful, said Darby.
He started a new book, and it might be about the port.
The pleasantries petered out as the workers had to get back to their torches. It was down to just Brady, Darby's closest friend from the old job. The sun began to set, and they grabbed plastic chairs, moving out on the concrete deck overlooking the municipal marina next door.
Man, it's great to see your face, said Brady, rubbing arthritic knuckles. Without you around, I'm the last of the old guard, and I'm getting too old for this shit.
So take your pension, said Darby.
And do what?
Brady flicked a wrist at a pleasure craft navigating the channel between Peanut Island.
Go sailing?
He turned to Kenny.
What do you think?
I'm a neutral observer. Darby watched a large yacht with a radar dome swing around in the turning basin.
I was starting to tell Kenny here about the glory days. Remember Turtle Eggs? And just when you think you've seen everything.
Brady faced Kenny again.
These eggs were headed for Port-au-Prince or some damn place. Customs did a routine sweep, and they were about to let the boat go when they heard this strange racket in some boxes. These were rookie smugglers who didn't know about refrigeration. The eggs hatched. All hell broke loose. People screaming and diving overboard, knocking over boxes, little turtles flapping around everywhere.
That's messed up, said Kenny. But I don't know if anyone can write a whole novel on turtle eggs.
That's just a for instance, said Darby. Crazy stuff like that was happening all the time, said Brady. Like the guys who brought these parrots up from Panama that sell for more than $2,000. Things got fucked up again. Naturally, they all flew away.
Don't forget the monkeys, said Darby.
Monkeys? Said Kenny, getting out a pen and notebook. These cute little gibbons, said Brady. They got loose, too, running through the welding shop and tearing up our break area. When people hear that you work at the port, they think, ooh, you must be worried about drug smugglers. I say no. Monkeys that can open your lunchbox.
See, here's the thing about people breaking the law out here. Darby watched a small Zodiac boat speed up the channel in growing darkness. They think they're so clever, and if they act cool and nonchalant, nobody will notice them. But the eyes that work on the docks see all. A pen scribbled.
So it's mainly exotic animal smuggling?
Brady shook his head and pointed at the cargo containers on the deck of a Liberian-flagged freighter.
Dollars to donuts, there's more than a few stolen cars in there. They love the Mercedes in South America.
Even more popular are spare parts from chopped vehicles that can't be traced.
Bicycles, said Darby.
Oh, you wouldn't believe what they pay in the islands for a 10-speed, said Brady. A used bicycle goes for twice the price of a new one in the States.
A small fish splashed next to the seawall, which meant a larger fish was behind it. Darby stretched weak legs under the table.
Changed much since I was here?
Starting to, said Brady.
And it's bad.
How? Asked Kenny.
There's always been contraband around here.
Brady nodded across the water to the nearby shore of Tony Palm Beach. A squadron of pelicans glided on the breeze.
Rum came in here like nobody's business during Prohibition because all that old money wanted to get their drink on. And one of the biggest smugglers lived over there. Probably heard of him. Joseph Kennedy, the president's dad. Of course, he never got his hands dirty, and all the law around here was on the take.
Then came the 60s, said Darby. We started seeing drugs, but it was mainly pot. Some stone clowns trying to make a few bucks. Half the time they could barely steer the boat and did more damage hitting the pylons than what they made off weed.
Right after Darby left, the worm turned, said Brady. It wasn't obvious at first, but then it couldn't be ignored. A much scarier breed of cat started showing up at the docks. Scars, prison tats, and not American prisons.
Cocaine? Said Darby.
We don't ask, but yeah, said Brady. It really got edgy when the police started showing up.
To make arrests? Asked Kenny.
To get paid.
Brady watched the fin of a small hammerhead slice across the channel.
Then the DEA came around, which was more frightening because they were on the level. Nobody wanted to be seen at the port talking to the feds. We all played dumb, which made them think that maybe we were in on it, so they planted one of their undercover agents in the shop.
If he was undercover, said Kenny, then how did you know he was DEA?
Couldn't weld and kept asking about cocaine. Call us suspicious, said Brady. Finally burned himself with the torches so many times that he was almost on permanent disability leave, and they pulled him off the assignment because what was the point if he was home in bed?
Kenny flipped a page in his notebook. I had no idea. Right in my own backyard.
Darby, Brady said uneventfully, did you see that Zodiac boat?
Darby nodded.
Right out the corner of my eye. Been watching since it made the channel.
Kenny turned around. What boat? Brady and Darby in unison.
Don't look!
Why not? What's going on?
Nothing you want to witness, said Brady. Zodiac boats are fast, but more importantly, they ride as shallow as anything out there. They definitely draft higher than whatever the Coast Guard or Marine Patrol has.
Darby made a circular gesture with his right arm. Probably met a sailboat offshore, then made the inlet. Brady pretended to look in the direction of a cargo container marked Tropicala.
Notice how the cooler is about 10 gallons too big for a Zodiac?
Picked up on that, said Darby. And how he's now straining too hard to lift it for anything legitimate to be inside.
Mm-hmm, said Brady.
Kenny's gaze ping-ponged between the two old friends.
Wow, I never would have noticed little things like that.
The eyes of the dark sea all.
The welders kept tabs with peripheral vision as the man carried the cooler and slid it into the bed of a nearby pickup truck. He grabbed a piece of paper from the vehicle, then got back in the Zodiac, undid a rope from a cleat, and sped away from the marina.
I have no idea what just happened, said Kenny. If there's something valuable like drugs in the cooler, why did he just leave it like that?
Dead drop, said Brady.
Apparently the arrangement involves the links in the chain not meeting face to face.
But the stuff's just sitting out in the open in the back of that truck where anyone can steal it, especially in Riviera Beach, said Kenny.
Or it could be discovered by the authorities who'll arrest the pickup's owner.
A couple of things, said Darby.
First, it's unsecured, so any decent defense attorney can argue that whoever owns the pickup isn't responsible for whatever someone might toss in the back when he isn't around. You said a couple of things?
Don't turn around and look obvious like you did before, said Darby, but there's a police car by the gate. Nothing will happen to that cooler.
Kenny jotted notes nonstop, head down, until he realized nobody at the table was talking. He raised his head and saw the men staring across the channel.
What are you looking at?
Now you can watch the Zodiac boat, said Brady. He did. The inflatable vessel quickly traversed the channel and made landfall on the sandy shore of Peanut Island. The man got out and walked toward a coconut palm that looked different from all the others, angling out crooked over the water. He reached the base of the tree and got down on his knees.
"Why is he digging?" asked Kenny.
"Payment," said Darby. "Another dead drop. Got the location from the map in the back of the pickup when he delivered the load." The man retrieved a small, waterproof nautical box from the sand and threw it in the Zodiac. He pushed the boat off and sped out of sight around the south end of the island toward the inlet. Moments later, another Zodiac came around the opposite end of the island and docked at the marina. A different man got out and walked over to the pickup. The truck started up, he drove off, and the police car followed. Darby turned with a sly grin toward the young writer. Getting enough material? Chapter 17 The Present. A moody espresso machine hissed a bitter liquid into a tiny cup that was promptly knocked back. The coffee aficionado wore a lime-green guayabera with two vertical rows of iguanas. He had a slight paunch, not unreasonable for his 50 years, but his toupee broke the cardinal rule of toupees by looking like one. Even across the street or looking down from a building. Yep, that's a toupee. His skin was mocha, and his name was Selenka. Nobody ever brought up the hairpiece, and Selenka thought it was the perfect crime. It was the industrial side of western Miami between the airport and the Everglades, an area where office buildings looked like warehouses and vice versa. This particular building wore both hats. Rooms stored drugs, guns, and stolen art. Others housed rows of employees on phones and computers. The drugs were being phased out. It was the new era of techno-crime, and ID theft was the future. Selenka had the only personal office, sitting up on steel beams near the ceiling at the end of the building and looking out over what used to be the shipping department of a T-shirt printing company. Months had passed since Selenka's big promotion. Nobody ever figured out that he had framed his boss for framing him. All they knew was that Selenka possessed the Midas touch. The credit card racket had money pouring in from 37 countries and counting. And who would have ever guessed they'd need to hire a tech staff? Selenka asked for another meeting with the bosses.
"What's this new idea of yours?"
"Garbage."
"Garbage?"
Selenka nodded.
"It's the future."
The bosses glanced at each other.
"I thought it was the past," said Boss One. "The families up in New York and Jersey were neck deep in garbage, until we showed them how much more could be made from cocaine."
Boss Two nodded.
"That's when they began switching from the waste business to drugs. And now you want us to go from drugs back to garbage?"
"No,"
said Selenka.
"That's old garbage. I'm talking batteries."
"Batteries?"
"It used to be just car batteries," said Selenka. "But technology has so radically evolved over the last 2 decades that it's created a sea change. Everyone's got a cell phone and a laptop, and they all have batteries that eventually need to be thrown away."
"So throw them away already."
"Not that simple."
Selenka popped the battery out of his own phone and held it up as a visual aid.
"It's about heavy metals. Cadmium, mercury, lead, You got your manganese, your lithium ion.
We'll take your word, said Boss Three. Skip to the money part.
There are all kinds of new federal regulations requiring businesses to dispose of certain types of garbage in specific ways. Expensive ways, said Selenka. And not just batteries, but medical waste, construction materials like asbestos. The list goes on and on.
How does that concern us? Asked Boss One.
It's often too costly for companies to get rid of the stuff themselves, said the accountant. So now all these new businesses have cropped up that specialize in regulated disposal. They're hired by the other companies. That's where we come in, underbidding the competition and making a fortune.
Do we know how to dispose of this stuff? Asked Boss Three.
Not remotely. That's why we'll dump it at night. That's our profit margin.
What if these other companies don't want to sign contracts with us? Asked Boss One.
Our best sales pitch. Muscle and arson.
Forgive me, said Boss Two, but this sounds like a lot of work. Is it more profitable than drugs or ID theft?
No, but the cost-benefit ratio is better.
Selenka could see their eyes glazing over.
Remember when I explained the disparity of prison sentences between cocaine and credit cards? The less harsh the penalties, the lower the chance that someone will flip on us for the prosecution. And the risk is even less for disposal violations. We incorporate a legitimate company, and if they hit us with EPA fines, we just bankrupt it. And if they go after corporate officers, they're all overseas associates of ours in places without extradition. It's about diversification. We'll basically be getting paid a killing for creating a lot of confusing paperwork.
Confusing is a good way to put it, said Boss One. I don't understand any of this, and I love it. What will you need?
More guys and a bulldozer.
The bosses took a vote, consisting of nodding at each other. They set the accountant loose. Selenka sat in a posh chair on the 19th floor of a gleaming office building in downtown Miami. A vice president sat on the other side of a mahogany desk. He had a view of the causeways to the beaches. He closed a leather-bound prospectus.
I'm sorry, but we already have a company we're very happy with.
We cost less, said Selenka.
It's not worth the unknown, said the VP. They have a proven track record.
So do we, but not in disposal.
How do you mean? Selenka turned east toward the floor-to-ceiling windows, looking down at a seaplane skimming across the bay before taking off to the Bahamas.
You like your view?
Yeah. Selenka pointed up at the two serious men standing behind him with clasped hands. No necks. Linebackers in shiny suits. The VP quickly opened the leather binder again.
Come to think of it, we have had some reliability issues lately with the current company.
And so it went, downtown tower after tower, collecting contracts. Selenka assembled his reinforced crew back at the warehouse the next morning at dawn. He distributed pages with their collection routes.
Don't we need garbage trucks?
Selenka shook his head.
This kind of waste doesn't take up as much room. Your pickups will do.
Is any of this stuff dangerous?
Asked another driver. Selenka handed him a page.
Just watch out for syringes in the biomedical containers.
They read down their assignments as Selenka stepped back.
Okay, everybody, look alive. The collection is child's play. And you all know the rallying point, but you must arrive at the precise 10-minute intervals on your sheets. We don't need a million pickups there at the same time attracting attention. And don't go anywhere near the place before midnight.
The western sprawl of South Florida was like a military campaign. Aggressive, coordinated, and ruthless. All along Highway 27 and the Sawgrass Expressway, charging right up against the boundary of the Everglades. It was a fortified wall of sorts. Tight rows of identical two-story stucco homes, all designed for maximum floor space on minimum lot size. Swimming pools, barbecue pits, jacuzzis. On the other side of the wall, alligators. Each subdivision opened with tours of the model home, and before the first deed was inked, bulldozers were already plowing the next subdivision. One such bulldozer arrived at midnight on a flatbed truck. It was not sent by the developers. In all directions, empty land, cleared and packed flat with little orange ribbons flapping from surveyors' stakes. In coming weeks, the acreage would be a compelling subject for time-lapse photography. All at once, an entire platted community would rise. Plumbing, slabs, concrete blocks, roof trusses, plywood, shingles, paint, sod, and cheerful nuclear families whose key to happiness was lack of imagination. But right now, there weren't even streetlights. Workers backed the bulldozer off the flatbed.
"Why'd you pick this particular lot?" asked the man behind the controls of the big Tonka truck.
Selenka waved a clipboard.
"They just poured the footers, so the foundation isn't far off."
The bulldozer rolled onto the land as the first pickup truck arrived. Men quickly pulled the tarp off the bed and unloaded the contents. They carried it to the middle of the lot, where a kitchen with an island sink would soon stand. The bulldozer finished digging the hole, and they threw it all in. Selenka checked his watch. The departing pickup passed the incoming one on the dark street, and the process repeated. And repeated. Every 10 minutes, until the last truck arrived.
"Hold it," said Selenka. "Don't dump. I've got other plans for your load."
The next day before lunch, the driver of the last pickup arrived at the warehouse with hazardous cargo still under its tarp.
"Follow us,"
Selenka said out the passenger side of a Mercedes.
"Hope you don't mind me asking," said the driver, "but why are we taking the last load to the disposal company whose contracts we just stole?"
"To create a paper trail that we disposed of some of it according to regulations," said Selenka. "Then if any of what we're doing turns up, we point the finger at them."
"Sounds like a lot of effort for just a paper trail," said the driver. "Won't they just deny it?"
"They won't be in a position to be believed."
"I get it. You're planning something else."
"This is a two birds with one stone kind of thing."
Minutes later, another high-rise executive office.
"I can't believe you're sitting there."
"Why?"
asked Selenka.
"You stole a bunch of our clients with underhanded tactics, and you have the balls to come into my office?"
said the exec.
"You don't want our business?"
"Get the hell out of here."
"You can always file a complaint," said Selenka.
He pointed up at the linebackers in suits.
"And there's the complaint department."
A pickup truck backed into the receiving bay and unloaded. Selenka removed a document from his clipboard and handed it to the dispatcher.
"Here's a manifest of the contents."
That night, the pickup trucks arrived at the rallying point in staggered sequence. The bulldozer and freshly dug pit were waiting. Everything proceeded exactly as it had the night before. Selenka stepped into the headlights of the last incoming pickup and put up his hands.
"Stop!"
"You don't want me to dump?"
asked the driver.
"Not here."
Selenka headed back to his Benz.
"Follow us."
Shortly before dawn, they all arrived behind the legitimate disposal company that Selenka had visited the day before. He got out of the Benz and walked back to the pickup driver's window.
"Cut your headlights. See those dumpsters behind the building?"
The driver nodded. Selenka stood with his associates from the Benz, watching the pickup swing around back and unload the cargo into the trash bins.
"Now I'm totally confused," said the accountant's driver.
"We didn't get as many contracts as I had hoped," said Selenka. "I only intended to use the threat of violence because roughing up civilians is bad business. Some of the companies called my bluff. So it's time to thin the competition."
"Would I be correct to assume that what's being tossed in those dumpsters right now is similar to the manifest of what we dropped off here yesterday?"
identical.
Salenka waited until banking hours before calling in the anonymous tip on a burner phone. The feds did what they do best, be feds. Hazmat teams collected the illegal waste from the dumpsters. Padlocks snapped shut on the receiving bay's roll-down doors. TV cameras filmed agents escorting executives from the building. Salenka's regular cell phone began ringing non-stop. All the holdout companies had garbage stacking up, and they were now calling him. Salenka was happy, and his bosses even happier. Collections multiplied. They added more trucks. Dumps at the rallying points became logistical operations. Offshore accounts bulged. Everything going like silk. Until the police car showed up. Future subdivisions were not on the officers' routine patrol because they were just empty lots, but the officer was on the nearby expressway when he caught a glimpse of the bulldozer chugging away in the middle of the night, and a Mercedes. Luckily, the last load had been dropped, and the dozer was pushing soil back into the hole. The cop exited his patrol car with a flashlight. Salenka smiled and met him halfway.
How can I help you, officer?
Why are you here at this hour?
Wish I wasn't,
Salenka said with an air of disgust.
We're pouring 20 foundations in the morning. I was spot-checking and found improperly prepped footprints. That's how you end up with cracked slabs and lawsuits. And now I have to be back out here in 4 hours.
All the officer saw were people working. Strange hour, but no potential crime, except maybe vandalizing dirt. Okay, take care.
You too, officer.
Later that day, an emergency meeting in the warehouse. Salenka walked down a line of men at attention, handing them pages.
I'm sure you've all heard about our close brush last night, said Salenka. From now on, we're using a new disposal technique.
What kind?
One that eliminates the cost of a bulldozer.
Chapter 18 1989 The sound of typewriter keys in the bungalow was something that always made Darby smile.
How's it coming in there, kid?
Half and half.
What's that mean?
Well, I've got lots of great action for the first part of the book with all the crazy exotic animals and stolen cars, but I don't have an ending, and I always start at the ending. Hell, I don't even have the middle bridge.
That can be fixed, said Darby. I'll give you all the bridges and endings you need.
Plus, I personally knew my subject matter in the other ones, but I really don't know anything about the port of Palm Beach. I'm running low on details to paint it in the reader's mind.
That's an even easier fix. Darby grabbed his cane. Let's go.
Now? It's really late.
Best time.
They arrived at the port, and Kenny drove toward where they had parked the other day when he met Brady and the rest of the old welding gang. Darby surveyed the nightscape, which he could read like the waves.
Let me out, said the Pope. Then park on the other side of the dock, by the rail yard, and walk back.
Why?
The late hour. In certain situations, it's helpful to create separation from your vehicle, said the Pope. There are many reasons, and if one ever comes up, you'll understand the value.
Kenny shrugged, but did as he was told. After parking, he began the hike back along the desolate industrial waterfront. Nobody around to ask any nosy questions. This would be impossible today, with all the homeland security after 9/11. But it was still the 1980s, when few could envision the day that the port would need to start inspecting cargo containers with Geiger counters. The young writer completed his trek and rejoined Darby at their regular spot on the docks behind the welding shop. They dragged over plastic chairs, and Kenny got out his notebook.
Don't take notes, said Darby. Just sit and absorb.
Kenny absorbed. The twinkling lights on the waterfront mansions across Lake Worth. Running lights on motorboats. Headlights crossing the tall arch of the new Blue Heron Bridge. Security lights blazing in the rail yard. The moon was just bright enough to make out the pines and palms on Peanut Island. Over at the adjacent marina, it was dark in a particular spot where it usually wasn't. Only someone who knew the port like Darby would have noticed.
"What are you looking at?" asked Kenny.
"Shh." He kept his eyes on a boat ramp where the security lamp was out. This time it wasn't a Zodiac. It was a scuba diver. He had just swum under a nearby cargo ship and unfastened a load of cocaine from a giant magnet, which another scuba diver had attached to the hull in South America. The diver left his fins and tank on the pier and delivered the load to the open bed of a waiting pickup truck. Then he went back to the ramp and swam away toward Peanut Island. Darby turned to Kenny and raised his eyebrows. Kenny continued typing during the day and hanging out at the port at night. It wasn't eventful like the first two times. In fact, it was boring.
"This is boring," said Kenny.
"Boring is when you notice stuff." Kenny noticed inbound planes from Europe, some kind of party going on behind a mansion. The police cruiser that had just pulled up, then footsteps. Kenny's hands reflexively covered his face when the flashlight beam hit them.
"What the hell are you doing here?"
"Roger."
"Oh, it's you, Darby."
The officer clicked the flashlight off.
"Listen, you really shouldn't be out here this late."
"Why not?" The cop exhaled.
"Darby, don't bust my balls. You know what's going on."
Darby moved in and out of all circles in town, including some he couldn't exactly tell Kenny about. He wasn't involved in anything himself, but he was trusted. The officer headed back to his car.
"Just be careful."
The typing in the bungalow accelerated with each new trip to the port.
"I need some of that plot help you were talking about."
"I'm there."
Darby hobbled into the kitchen.
"I wrote down a few ideas."
"Thanks."
Clack, clack, clack.
"I can actually see the rest of the book in my head now."
Darby was asleep in his chair, dreaming about a bygone time when his body was whole, on top of a wave, beside a rusty, grounded ship. Something roused him. Kenny shook his shoulder.
"Sorry to wake you, but I'm at an important part in the second draft. Remember how you said that if I couldn't vividly visualize something myself, there's no way I could get the reader to?"
A groggy Darby tried to clear the fog.
"I remember what I told you. What do you need?"
"Go back to the port to get my head in the right place to see everything with new eyes. The slow-motion climax needs more details."
"Give me a minute to get my bearings."
Darby rubbed his face.
"What time is it?"
"Almost 2.
They were soon back on the dock in their usual plastic chairs.
"I love the ending you gave me," said Kenny. "They'll never see that coming."
"Glad you liked it. And you might even get some more material tonight."
"Why do you say that?"
"Don't be obvious," said Darby. "Just act like you're talking to me and peek over my left shoulder."
"A police car? But we see them all the time."
"Except there are 2 officers in the car tonight. That means something's on."
"You notice everything."
The black and white cruiser sat 50 yards back, officers facing the water with their lights off, eating egg salad sandwiches and drinking coffee from styrofoam. Killing time. Darby and Kenny were enjoying the uncomplicated pleasure of a balmy breeze off the water. Most of the mansion's lights were out across Lake Worth. Traffic on the giant arch bridge to Singer Island was down to nothing. Darby felt a subconscious tug from the days of the old low drawbridge. Some of the best bridge fishing in Florida. Practically deep sea with the huge stuff that swam in that inlet. Kenny was having his own throwback moment. Aroma memories of fresh fried catfish, hush puppies, and slaw from the crab pot under the end of the bridge.
"Ever camped on Peanut Island?" asked Darby.
"Many times," said Kenny. "Scouts, Little League, skinny kids lining up for that rope swing from the giant tree near the edge of the shore.
Every kid around here remembers that rope swing.
But remember how you had to swing way out to clear all the land and roots before letting go and diving in the water? We could have broken our necks.
Wouldn't have been worth doing otherwise."
Kenny turned around.
"What was that?"
"Be still." They listened. A deep motorized sound out in the water. They looked in that direction, but no running lights.
"This is a big one. Diesel," said Darby.
"Running slow." Kenny glanced to his left. "Someone unscrewed the light bulbs on the pier again." They sat back to enjoy the show. From the darkness appeared the fiasco of an old shrimp boat pumping way too much smoke and laboring as it chugged toward the docks like something important was about to snap in the engine. A few curt shouts and a couple of guys low on the totem pole leaped onto the pier and tied off the boat. Movement on the dim deck.
"That settles that," said Darby. "They didn't use any knots to tie the boat off. Just wrapped the rope a bunch of times around the cleats."
"What's that mean?"
"These are no legitimate shrimpers."
Kenny smiled. "The eyes of the dock see all." They watched a minivan pull up. No dead drop this time. Shipment must be too large. Cooler after cooler came off the boat. From behind them.
"Enjoying yourselves tonight?"
"How did one of the police officers sneak up like that? I must be getting old."
Darby turned around. No police officer. Instead, tank top, shorts, non-skid boat shoes. Bushy hair and mustache, almost a gray complexion. He stooped and set down a leather satchel, boxy on the bottom, tapering to the latch and handle. He straightened back up.
"Not doing too bad," said Darby, looking by the man's side. "What's the sawed-off shotgun for?"
"What, this?"
He waved it offhand toward the water.
"Comes in handy. Kind of a universal tool in my line of work."
"Why don't you have a seat?" said Darby. "It's a pleasant evening."
"Was pleasant."
"Okay, we're definitely drifting in the wrong direction." Darby knew interpersonal dynamics. An escalation like that meant the man wasn't trying to arrive at a decision. One had already been made. Darby needed to undo it. The man lit a cigarette.
"We've been noticing that you're frequent visitors down here at night."
"We like the water."
He turned to Kenny.
"Isn't that right?"
Kenny was about to stroke out. His eyes responded. "How can you even function, let alone talk so calmly?" A drag on the cigarette.
"Your friend's the quiet type. A nice touch with your cane. Nobody would ever suspect."
"Suspect what?"
"That you're DEA.
He waved the shotgun toward them.
"Get up, both of you."
"Just stop," said Darby.
"Listen, whatever it is you're thinking, I'm only a guy who used to weld in that shop behind you before I went on disability. I'm not a narc."
The cigarette was flicked into the water with a sizzle.
"Get up."
"You're making a huge mistake," said Darby.
"Don't act like you don't know what's going on."
"Of course I know what's going on," said Darby. "The whole dock does. You're too obvious. But I don't go talking about what's none of my business. Ask around."
Darby pointed.
"Heck, ask those cops over there."
"Oh, I'll be having a nice long discussion with those gentlemen about letting a couple of feds in here after all we've paid them."
Before that point, it was just drifting the wrong way. But now, they had crossed the Rubicon.
admitting to bribing cops. Not the sort of thing you tell people that you let go. The end of the 12-gauge poked Darby's rib. Up. Chapter 19. The Present.
Silly Putty.
I remember Silly Putty, said Coleman. He came in a little plastic egg.
Forget what the experts say. Silly Putty was the great generational divide.
Surge raced south on Dixie Highway out of Miami.
Today it's all flashy game boxes, but back then kids were hands-on.
Remember pressing Silly Putty on comic strips and newspapers, and then you'd peel it off, and the comic strip would be on the putty?
I took it to the next level, said Surge. My folks wouldn't buy me a Xerox machine no matter how many times I asked. I even put it on my Christmas list, which is supposed to go unquestioned like a papal decree. Surge, why on earth do you need a Xerox machine? We're living in important times, that's all I can say. So I had to improvise, and Silly Putty became my copy machine that I'd use to make duplicates of newspaper articles on Nixon.
I ate Silly Putty, said Coleman. Didn't taste bad, unless it was after comic strips and full of ink. And then my kindergarten teachers asked why my tongue was black again.
Did you used to put everything in your mouth?
Pretty much. Coleman put a hardcover book to his mouth and sucked.
Where to now?
Coleman, what on earth?
He exhaled a cloud of pot smoke.
Oh, this?
He opened the book to chapter 3.
I hollowed out some pages, used a liquid soap pump bottle for the chamber, made the stem from a metal pen. The carburetor is on the back end of the pages, and I suck right here in the middle of the title.
You made a bong from a novel?
Figured since we're on your literary tour. Another hit.
No, you're missing my meaning, said Surge. Why would you make a bong from a book in the first place?
Coleman exhaled more smoke.
So people will think I'm smart.
Surge blinked hard to reset his brain.
I lost my place.
Where are we going?
Right, the next literary tour stop.
Surge took his hands from the wheel and rubbed them with high friction.
When you mention Florida authors, people always blurt out Hemingway and Tennessee Williams, but they weren't full-time Floridians. Interestingly enough, our biggest lifelong literary lions were women, and we had a bumper crop. Marjorie Kennan Rawlings, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, Zora Neale Hurston. For some reason, they all had three names, like assassins.
The green Nova hung a right on Sunset Drive and entered the thriving subtropical jungle of a neighborhood called Coconut Grove.
Banyan trees,
said Surge.
I can't get enough of banyans. I'm all about banyans.
Didn't a chick get stuck in one last year in Key West? Asked Coleman.
Yes, and she was only 3 feet off the ground, said Surge. Instead of a single trunk, many have complex support structures that you can climb inside and get stuck. That's the beauty of banyans.
10 minutes later, neighbors gathered on the sidewalk. The homeowner stormed out his front door.
What in heaven's name is going on?
We're stuck,
said Surge, only an arm exposed.
Isn't it great?
Help,
said Coleman, wiggling a sneakered foot out the side of the trunk.
Get the hell off my property!
Maybe you need to look up stuck in the dictionary, said Surge. Banyans are also in the fig family, another big selling point.
I'm calling the police.
I'm also an escape artist, said Surge.
He hoisted himself up by an aerial route, then pulled Coleman free. They hopped down.
You have this magnificent century-old banyan on your property and you've never gotten stuck in it? You're living a lie.
Leave! Now!
We have an appointment with history anyway.
The Nova took off. Coleman looked out the back window at the gawking crowd in the street.
What was their problem?
It's all political.
Surge cut the wheel.
People say they want change, but whenever I show up...
The Nova passed a street sign, Stewart Avenue. Surge slowed as they navigated a winding, tree-canopied road just a spit from Biscayne Bay.
Almost there. Almost there.
Look at these big honking houses, said Coleman.
Surge checked street numbers.
There it is, 3744.
Where?
Back in all that vegetation?
Coleman hung out the passenger window.
What's that tiny little home doing in the middle of all these mansions?
Being preserved, thank God.
Serge eased up to the curb.
It's Marjorie Stoneman Douglas's old home. Exactly the kind of place I'd expect her to live.
It looks weird.
Because it's tasteful,
said Serge.
Like a modest English cottage. Stucco, brick, and cypress timber with curved wooden shingles. Built 1926.
Can we go inside?
It's not open to the public, but we can look in the windows,
said Serge.
Actually, we're not supposed to, but there are certain things beyond our control.
Serge trotted across the yard with a thermos of coffee and pressed his face to glass.
You have to understand what this area was like back then. You say Miami, and everyone pictures a giant metropolis that's been here forever. But in those early days, it was virtually nothing. The kind of place that you drive through today, and all you'd notice is that the speed limit drops for a couple minutes. Some hardy souls, however, knew paradise when they discovered it, and settled here on the edge of the bay.
Looks dusty inside.
That's why you have to use your imagination engine, said Serge. It was a rare intersection of a magic time and place. I'm going to take a look. Engine on.
He closed his eyes a few moments. They flew back open.
Whoa, that was intense.
Let me take a look, said Coleman.
He closed his eyes.
It's just dark.
That's because you're on the wrong channel, said Serge. In your case, the whole cable service is probably down.
His face returned to the window.
I'm getting chills. Right in there is where she wrote the opus, and I just conjured the image of Marjorie sitting at a desk typing away on her history-setting 1947 masterpiece, The Everglades, River of Grass.
Coleman's nose smudged the window.
Never heard of it.
Serge seized his pal by the front of his shirt.
What? It's just the most important Florida book ever published. Changed the course of the entire state.
Please let go.
Sorry, I'm in a time flux right now, so the astral plane is unstable.
He took a sip of coffee.
It's hard to conceive, but before Douglas, the common wisdom was that the Everglades were something that people needed to put a stop to.
Why?
It was considered a worthless, water-clogged waste of land.
Serge spread his arms expansively.
Plan after plan was floated to drain and fill the swamp so we could all stay in hotels and play golf. But Marjorie was the lone beacon. She stood in defiant opposition, beginning her book with a call to arms that this was the only Everglades we had in the whole world. I like books that tell everybody they're wrong.
What happened? Asked Coleman.
I'll show you.
He took off running.
Back to the car.
The Nova sped north into Little Havana and picked up Calle Ocho, the local designation of the Tamiami Trail.
There's a pet store, said Coleman. Can we stop?
10 minutes later, Serge turned west and drove along a canal. A cat toy was now suction-cupped to the windshield. It was plastic and pear-shaped, with numerous holes and a furry mouse inside. Jingle bells hung from the bottom. Coleman batted it around and drooled. The last landscape neighborhoods dribbled off into the wildness of the glades. They came upon an anonymous dirt road.
I love anonymous dirt roads. Anything can happen.
The Chevy sat still a half mile later, wind and birds and a flat panorama untouched by the hand of man.
This is what I'm talking about,
said Serge.
The perfect place.
The perfect place to smoke dope, said Coleman. Nobody messes with you.
No,
said Serge.
I'm talking about Douglas's legacy. Without her, we might be looking at outlet malls and laser tag hippodromes. The cosmos rewarded Marjorie by letting her live to a ripe 108 years.
Wow, said Coleman. That's older than being dead.
You are an existentialist.
Serge broke out his camera as the sun began to set on the western horizon. Click, click, click.
The most excellent part is after dark, when a whole nother world blooms.
It got dark. And loud. Insects, frogs, more birds. Jingle, jingle.
Coleman, what are you doing?
Thinking like a cat.
Coleman exhaled an extra large hit of pot into the cat toy. Then he quickly moved his hands, covering one hole after another.
Smoke's coming out there,
Now there, now over here. He put one of the holes to his mouth and sucked. Now there, and there. Sucking again. Over there.
Coleman!
I got the mouse's tail. Jingle, jingle. Serge stared.
Are you finished, Tinkerbell?
Look, said Coleman. Here comes the moon.
And here comes some headlights.
Who do you think it is? Asked Coleman.
Probably a fellow nature lover, said Serge. There's no other reason to be out here.
The headlights turned off, and so did the engine. A moonlit silhouette got out. The moon hit another silhouette, a naked woman on a Playboy bumper sticker.
I don't think he saw us.
Coleman held his joint down to conceal the glowing orange tip.
What's he doing?
Not sure, said Serge. He's going around to the back of the pickup truck.
They watched for clues at a range of 100 yards, but none arrived.
Now he's getting back in the truck and leaving, said Coleman.
When someone comes out to such a remote area and only stays a few minutes, it usually isn't a constructive activity.
Serge started up the Nova and slung dirt as he sped to the spot where the other vehicle had parked. He leaped out with a flashlight, scanning the watery nests of reeds and bulrushes. He seized his heart and jumped back.
Dear God and all the saints!
What is it?
Asked Coleman. Serge grabbed his friend for balance. He lowered his forehead onto Coleman's shoulder and began to cry.
Easy there, buddy. Coleman patted the back of his head. It can't be that bad.
Sniffles.
It is. Just look.
Serge raised his head and aimed the flashlight again.
Asbestos, biomedical waste, and yikes, I didn't see that before.
What is it?
Computer and cell phone batteries.
Serge bent down.
That means heavy metals. Cadmium, lead, mercury, chromium, manganese, zinc, all leaching into the delicate food chain.
A turtle just crawled on top of a battery, said Coleman.
No!
Serge splashed down into the water and picked up the critter, tossing it a short distance.
Live long and prosper.
Then a boomerang mood swing. Serge jumped back in the Nova, and Coleman ran alongside until he could lunge in.
What's the plan?
Said an upside-down Coleman on the passenger side.
He's got a head start, but there's only one route back to Miami, and we've got miles of swamp to make up ground.
The needle arced across the speedometer.
Keep your eyes peeled for a pickup.
How will you know which one?
Oh, I'll know.
The Nova blazed east on the Tamiami. There was such a differential in velocity with the other cars in their lane that the approaching red taillights almost seemed like oncoming traffic. Serge whipped around each motorist in turn. Coleman watched them go by.
Serge, you're freaking out every driver you're passing.
No answer. Eyes low, locked on the back end of the next vehicle. A Ford pickup.
Hey, Serge, there's the Playboy bumper sticker.
He never slowed, blowing by the truck. Then he slowed, and slowed some more, checking the rear view.
What are you doing?
Asked Coleman.
Making him go around. I need him on my driver's side.
The pickup pulled out into the oncoming lane. Its driver let off the gas as he passed, in order to let Serge know how he felt about matters.
Look, said Coleman. He's giving you the bird.
Serge simply aimed a pistol out the window and shot the front tire. Chapter 20 1989 The sight of the shotgun spoke silent volumes. Darby studied the man's dilated pupils, fidgetiness, and sniffles. He clearly had been dipping into his own product. It's hard enough reasoning with a psychopath, but add chemicals, and it's a fool's errand.
Stand up, goddammit!
Darby raised his hand.
Okay, okay.
Back in the police car, officers balled up wax paper from their sandwiches and poured the dregs of their coffee out the windows.
Oh, shit. Roger, look!
Hector's got Darby and that other guy, said the officer in the passenger seat.
What the hell is he thinking?
They're being marched down to the end of that dock with a shotgun. This can't end well.
What do we do? What can we do? If we run out there, we risk showing that we're involved.
He just jabbed Darby in the back again with the gun.
The cops continued observing as the Pope and Kenny stood side by side at the very end of the pier, with their heels hanging over the edge, hands in the air, staring down the shotgun.
There's one thing we can do.
The officer leaned and hit a couple of switches. A rack of red and blue lights came on with a single whoop of the siren. The man with the shotgun turned and gave the officers the finger.
That is bad.
At the end of the dock, Darby watched his captor flip off the cops, then saw the shotgun swing back around. Reckoning. Some people freeze. Others kick in with magnified focus. Darby saw everything in slow motion. Tunnel vision. All sound dropped out in his ears, except a high-pitched ringing. As the thick barrel was almost back to him, Darby spun. His right hand swatted the barrel aside, then both hands shoved Kenny hard off the end of the pier.
Blam!
Kenny had just surfaced in the dark water when Darby's body splashed next to him. The Pope was face down, the blast clear through him with a large red circle in the back of his shirt. Kenny's eyes almost popped out of his head. A brief yelp of a scream before he covered his mouth.
Get that other guy! We can't leave a witness!
A hail of bullets from a half-dozen guns raked the water without aim. Kenny dove back under. He didn't know the port anywhere near as well as Darby, but he'd been spending enough time there to know how the piers and docks met and curved and formed the best hiding spots for someone in his situation. He held his breath until reaching the dark overhang of the next pier, cutting himself on barnacles as he clung to a piling.
Bang, 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 bang! Stop it!
Their leader waved both arms in the air.
Knock it off!
The guns went quiet, and they all looked at Hector.
Do you see him?
They shook their heads.
Then what are you shooting at?
The water? The gang looked over the side of the pier into a light chop. A dead snook bobbed to the surface.
Brilliant, said the leader. You prevented a fish from testifying. No more shooting unless you see him. You're just making noise, and we need to be able to hear his splashing.
They stopped and listened. Kenny remained still. Both cops were out of their car now, sprinting down the pier.
Fuck me! Hector, what have you done?
The leader turned around.
Took care of something you should have. Do we not pay you enough? Do you not understand that letting a couple of DEA agents in here is not compatible with our business? DEA agents? Are you insane?
The officer pointed at the body floating out into the channel.
That's the Pope. The Pope. His nickname, Darby. Everyone knows him.
The officer grabbed his head with both hands.
You've just brought the world down on all of us. Is he someone important? Politician? Connected businessman? No, a retired welder who used to surf, said the officer. But everyone liked him. You're telling us we should be scared because people liked him?
You don't know this town, said the other cop. Why did you have to shoot him? He was just sitting out there minding his own business.
Wait, back up. You knew he was sitting out here watching our whole operation?
He could be trusted. It was Darby.
Hector tightened his lips in frustration.
We'll continue this most enjoyable conversation later. But right now we have a more immediate problem. A witness got away, and your well-timed interruption is helping him escape.
It was.